This is an ABC podcast.
Every city in Australia has its particular old food traditions. And in Adelaide, it's the famous Cornish pasty, a crescent of pastry baked with diced veggies and mince with plenty of pepper. My grandmother used to make them. This was a food tradition brought to South Australia by Cornish mining families who arrived in the 19th century. They were nicknamed Cousin Jacks and Cousin Jennies. Many of them lived in a copper mining town just north of Adelaide on the York Peninsula that's called Moonta, where they lived alongside the descendants of German migrants. Moonta is where Kristen Wiedenbach's family and her father grew up, and she went there for weekends and holidays when she was a kid. And Kristen often heard her dad tell stories from this other place and other time, where people had the milk and butcher's meat delivered to their doors along with their underwear, where travelling salesmen went from door to door with immaculate cases packed with dress pins and household remedies, and where there was a strong community spirit with the odd ghastly murder. And so just before her dad died, Kristen sat down with him and drew down these stories, and she's captured this lost world in her book that's called Growing Up Moonta. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Richard.
Why did you want to write a book based on this vanished world?
Well, as you say, I had grown up all my life going to Moonta. We would travel there long weekends, Easter, you know, or for Christmas vacation. So it was just part of life. You know, Grandma and Grandpa lived there in the house. And my dad had been telling these stories about the people of Moonta all his life. And so we felt that we knew all these people and were a part of the town. And, yeah, just one, oh, not one day, but I wanted to get the stories down on paper. So it wasn't something that I decided to do because, you know, that dad died or whatever. But I started on this project 10 years ago. So it was a long time.
Right. 10 years.
Yeah,
right.
10 years ago. So I had it. When you make a living as a writer, you're always working on different projects. So sort of something that would get put aside, I'd do some interviews. I taped all my interviews with people that dad had gone to school with and the people, you know, butchers in the town, the fire chief, all of these sort of folks over time. And, you know, eventually thought, well, I'll get it together into a book, which took a lot longer than I thought.
I remember when I was a kid, when you go to visit your grandparents, you have this feeling like at some point when people reach past a certain age, they just can't be bothered keeping up with the modern world. And so when you go as a grandchild in your grandparents' house, you have that kind of feeling. It's lovely and it's nice, but it's also weird, isn't it? Because you feel like you're stepping back several decades. Was it like that for you when you go to stay with your grandparents?
It was lovely. My grandma died when I was quite young. So I was only sort of 6 or 7 when she died. So it was mostly Grandpa there on his own in this big house. We'd go down the corridor and always, you know, sort of be dark when we'd arrive in the evening, and Grandpa would be sitting up in the lounge room with, you know, a bag of licorice all sorts, watching TV.
Did he have an antimacassar on the back of the chair?
Yeah.
Like my granddad did? Right, yeah. You have to put the antimacassar in the chair for him when he'd come to visit and then put a glass of beer in front of him.
Well, no, I don't remember seeing him drink, but he always had a bag of lollies to watch TV. And the other thing I remember my sister saying, because when we were there, of course, we'd, you know, do help with meals and do the dishes and everything. And I remember my sister saying to me once, you know, Grandpa never does the dishes when we're not here, because we always did them when we were there. And I remember sort of thinking, I don't see how that works, you know, like there's never a big pile of dishes when we get here, but of course.
Since you were there, you might as well do it. No. Was it a place of homemade jams and that kind of a thing?
Yes, well, homemade jam was a bit of a thing because we, as children, my grandma would make plum jam, apricot jam, and it was always a bit of a thrill to find the stone in the jam. But of course, grandma, she was quite a worrier, you know, very dithery, always worrying about things going wrong, nervous in the car and that sort of thing. So she would be particularly careful that we wouldn't choke on the stone. So she would take the stones out before we got the jam on the toast. So it was always a little disappointing because we'd be looking forward to finding the stone, like finding a 5-cent piece in the Christmas pudding. And Grandma had taken them out. So
terrified that her grandchildren would die a horrible choking death in front of her because of some sort of stone. Right. So once you decided to write down some of these stories, how did you extract them from your dad?
Well, Dad was a storyteller, you know, and that was the thing, I suppose, in the end that I realised, that he was a storyteller. I'm not so much a storyteller, but it's my job, you know, I decided to write them down. So there's no trouble getting Dad to tell stories, and, you know, my mum would sort of roll her eyes every now and again. It was like, oh, we've heard that one before. So it was really just wanting to capture them. And so I taped him, and I do that with all the interviews I do with the work I do, so that you really capture their voice. And sometimes it's the ums and the ahs and the manner of speech and the words they use that defines, you know, that person. So, you know, I'd just take my little tape recorder along and we'd be walking through the park or, you know, making buns at home or something and just say, Dad, tell me about the time Roy Roach, the butcher, spat on the weighing pan, you know, and he'd start telling that story or, you know, he's cleaning the weighing pan in front of all the customers and couldn't get this little bit of gristle or dried fat or something off of it and, you know, gave it another extra scrub, still wouldn't move. So then he leans over and spits on it and, you know, gave it an extra scrub. So all the customers are just standing there thinking, that's where my sausages are going
to
go.
Yes, that's right. That's where my chops are. Yeah. One of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you is because my mum grew up in Cadena, which is right next door to Moonta. Can you just explain that little triangle? It's called the Copper Triangle of towns in the York Peninsula, which is just, what is it, 2 hours drive north of Adelaide?
Yeah, 2 hours, yeah. So it is the Copper Triangle, it's known as now. So Cadena is the sort of the inland part of the triangle, and then Wallaroo's on the coast, that was where the port is and the smelting works, and then Moonta along the coast about 10 kilometres away. So they formed a triangle. Cadena, it was actually the site where the very first discovery was made in 1859. But confusingly, that little mine was called Wallaroo Mines, which is located at the town we now know as Cadena, which is the farming commercial centre of the district.
Yeah, Mum remembers it as a place where people in Cadena thought of themselves as the fine folk of the land, the landed people. And Cadena was the town where you'd come to town with your goods and there were prosperous farmers. And she said there was a bit of snobbery that they kind of looked down upon the working class Cornish folk of Moonta. And they were known as Cousin Jacks and Cousin Jennies. Why, do you know anything about that, why they were called Cousin Jacks and Cousin Jennies?
I don't know the real origin of the name, but that's how they came to Australia. Cousin Jacks were the Cornish miners that came out from Cornwall. They were the best hard rock miners in the world. So, you know, as opposed to, you know, gold miners and people that are panning, you know, in streams and things, alluvial deposits, copper and tin are in very deep, hard rock deposits. So the Cornish miners were the best in the world for that. So wherever there's a hole, you'll find a Cornishman at the bottom of it. So that's why they came to Moonta and this area, and they bought all their Cornish customs, their saffron buns and Cornish pasties and their Methodist religion and all their sort of traditions with them. And they were known as Cousin Jacks, and the wives who were whitewashing the cottages and looking, you know, baking indoors were the Cousin Jennies.
Having decided to put these stories to the page, did you go and then and live in Moonta for a while?
So other than having spent a lot of my holiday and childhood growing up there, when I really decided, right, this is my time of working on and making it into a book, in 2015, yes, I moved to Moonta. We still own the family house there that my grandpa lived in and Dad spent his later teenage years in. And so my daughter and I moved there and she went to school and walked down the road to the very same school that my dad had gone to, and his parents and his grandparents had all attended this beautiful stone building school. So she loved it, you know, just being able to walk to school and be part of a country community. And I loved going around the town and interviewing people and then sitting in the, you know, the backyard or in the dining room and working on my book.
Were they supportive of this, like the local townspeople? Did they want you to write this story?
Yeah, I don't know if they kind of really knew what the outcome would be, but I, you know, called people up and said, you know, you used to be the fire chief. I mean, our house is diagonally opposite the fire station, so we used to know the children of the fire chief, and back in the, you know, 70s, 80s, the fire station horn would go off every Sunday night. They'd basically check it, you know, to sort of see that it was working. So every Sunday at 7 p.m. this horn would blare out all over the district, and that was so you could sort of, you know, keep time. And but I interviewed people that he went to school with, and various, just the townsfolk, and just sat and chatted with them and reminisced, really. And it was quite interesting because sometimes I would go and say, so your auntie was, you know, the school teacher or whatever. I'd know more about their family background than they did in some instances.
Did you find that people still feel a strong attachment to the place, even people like your dad who left and never lived there again? Did they still, people who left, still feel that powerful attachment?
Yeah, I mean, Moonta had the largest population outside of Adelaide when the mines were operating. So it was a big, important part of South Australia. Lots of people have connections there, and then therefore lots of people have moved away. But there was one particular woman I interviewed who had gone to school with Dad, and she in later life lived in Perth or Western Australia. But she said, when people ask her where you come from, I always say Moonta, and she wants her ashes, you know, when she's passed, to be brought back to Moonta.
I'm with Kristen Wiedenbeck, who's written a book called Growing Up Moonta. Moonta is a town in the York Peninsula in South Australia, about a couple of hours' drive north of Adelaide. It was for many years a copper mining town, and she's collected stories from her father and from other long-time residents of the area and put them together in this book to sort of recreate this lost world. Seems like another Australia now. Now, this was a town that was a mining community. It was founded in the 19th century. Tell me about the man who set it up and who ran it like a kind of a benevolent dictatorship for a while.
Well, that was Captain Hancock, and so he was really the mine manager, but he was, it was a sort of like a company town, I guess, and so Captain Henry Richard Hancock, his initials were HRH, so he was sort of like, you know, His Royal Highness of Moonta. He was a staunch Methodist, you know, you sort of had to be seen to be going to church on Sunday if you wanted to be in Captain Hancock's good books for the rest of the week. But he, you know, he was also concerned with the education of his workers and set up, you know, a library and system where the boys could go to school and sort of get educated if they wanted to have a job as a picky boy, which was the young lads who would be picking out ore on the on these long trestle tables. They had to show that they'd been to, you know, the night school as well. They organised, you know, doctor's horse and cart cab, they called it the doctor's cab, to take people into town where the doctors and other sort of... It was Moonta, the town, grew up after the mine, and they're only about 2 kilometres apart, but the facilities for the town and the business part of the Moonta was separate from the mines a little bit. So he would, you know, make these opportunities for people to go in and see the doctor and things like that.
So he set up all the kind of the elements of civilization, like a library and a medical service and a school and all those things. What about sanitation, though?
Well, that was not so good, because it was, the mine was this very sort of haphazard place where people were living really amongst the mining machinery and equipment and construction, so it wasn't planned out at all, and so it was very haphazard, and therefore there was no proper sanitation system, no reticulated water. People had their rainwater tanks right next to their septic sewage pit, you know, so things like typhoid and diphtheria and whooping cough, you know, those they swept through the town in epidemics of great proportion, and there's a whole section of the Moonta Cemetery that's just unmarked children's graves where people would, there was up to 14 funerals a day when people were dying through these epidemics.
Was it a rich mine? Did it pay out for its investors?
It was hugely successful, and the copper from Moonta was of, you know, unrivalled purity and the quantity. It was being sold on the London Stock Exchange, and so it was, you know, much in demand. So the Walter Watson Hughes was the owner of the mine, the mining company, was, you know, found on his, the copper was found on his land. So money that he made from the Moonta mine was donated to set up Adelaide University. So there's a statue at the front of Adelaide Uni on North Terrace, which is Walter Watson Hughes being one of the prime benefactors to found the University of Adelaide.
This is part of, I suppose, the Methodism of these settlers, that Methodist belief encourages people to donate to set up these kind of institutions of civilization.
And I suppose, a work ethic. You know, you work hard and you do good deeds with your, you know, your work and with your money and your funds. It's not sort of, you don't go out drinking and, you know, carousing. You do, you know, charitable works and work for the good of the community.
I don't know. How do you have a gigantic boom mining town without alcohol, without kind of outrageous bouts of alcoholism and violence that are associated with it?
And I think that is a testament to, you know, Captain Hancock. You know, he sort of ruled the town and the Methodism. You know, there was 10 or 12, you know, different Methodist chapels in Moonta and the Moonta Mines, and, you know, these little sort of communities now, we'd say it's all Moonta, but back then, if they were a couple of kilometres apart and you're going in horse and cart, they're really considered a separate little township. So there was Yalta and East Moonta and Crossroads and Moonta Mines, and so they all had, you know, several churches, and, the Methodists kept everybody in line.
Despite this kind of high moral rectitude, there was the odd bit of scandalous behaviour. Tell me about the scandal that erupted in 1873 concerning a poisoning case where a woman named Elizabeth Woolcock was involved.
That's a really tragic story, and there has been a bit written about her. She's the only woman hanged in South Australia. So now, you know, we look at her case in a different light, but she basically was accused of poisoning her husband by lacing his Cornish pasty. that was the lunchtime crib with arsenic, and he died a slow, agonising death. And after his death, they then, you know, the coroner got involved and they realised that there was a case to answer. But this young girl, Elizabeth Wilcock, she had had a terribly traumatic life, had been abandoned by her mother, had been raped badly on the Victorian goldfields, and then found her way back to Moonta. But during her early life, she had worked in a chemist shop and had some knowledge of sort of chemicals and drugs and that sort of thing.
What sentence was she given? Their sentence, you say, is to be...
She was hung, yeah, so right. The only woman in South Australia. And she wrote this sort of confession after being in jail and, you know, having being served by a priest, and where she really, you know, confessed to the crime.
What did she write? You've got a bit of it in your book. I'd love you to read a little bit from it, because it's really heartrending. It's the grammar in it and the spelling is clunky, but it's so written from the heart.
Yeah, she says, "I was so ill-treated that I was quite out of my mind, and in an evil hour I yielded to the temptation. He was taken ill at the mine and came home and quarrelled with me, and Satan tempted me, and I gave him what I ought not. But I thought at the time, if I gave him time to prepare to meet his God, I should not do any great crime to send him out of the world. But I see my mistake now."
What was it that led her to want to kill?
So he had been an abusive, you know, husband, and she had actually left at one point, and then he'd come and sort of fetched her back from Adelaide and, you know, made her stay. But so she was a victim of abuse, and I think now, you know, that we would see that differently. And in fact, it was in 2004, Flinders University sort of recreated this trial, did a mock trial, and tried the evidence again, and they found in that case that she would have been, you know, exonerated, battered wife syndrome, or, you know, what they call that.
It was a mining town right up until the 1920s. And by the time your dad was born, the mine was closed. What went wrong? Did the mine run out? Did commodity prices drop? What happened?
Yeah, so the mine, you know, obviously it's like any mine. You take the you know, the low-hanging fruit first of all. So they mined the more surface deposits. So over the years, they're getting deeper and deeper. It becomes more and more expensive to mine. So eventually it becomes uneconomic. And so 1923, the mine closed, and it was like, you know, the heartbeat of the town stopping. They've got this big engine that's just beating, I think it's a very slow beat rate that's basically drawing the water out of the mines. So as you dig deeper down into the mine, you have, you know, the water table rises, so you're having to have this engine going the whole time to keep the mine running. So once they decide we're not operating anymore, the engine stops and sort of this heartbeat just dies, and then the water rises up and there's no hope of sort of recovery. So it just, you know, became a question of economics. And
so the heart literally stopped.
The heart stopped beating in the town, yeah.
So your dad was born a good 10 years after the closure of the mine. What was the town then? Why didn't it become a ghost town? How did it reinvent itself?
Well, having such a big population, there was people there. Of course, they started drifting away, but it became a centre of agriculture and fishing. So the farming and fishing community sort of rose to fill that void. My dad worked as a wheat boy in his teenage years, and it had the biggest harvest in the state coming into the Moonta wheat yards in the 1940s. So different to what we know now as, you know, silos and wheat being handled in bulk. It was then, you know, you filled up an individual wheat bag, sewed it closed with the ears on the bag, put it on a truck, drove it to the railway station. They had this enormous stack of wheat, which was like a big, you know, warehouse building that was just made of wheat bags. And then they'd, from there, put them all on the train, and then they'd get taken away. So the wheat boys would help with all this unloading and stacking and organising at the wheat yards.
So when your dad was born in 1933, what were the living arrangements like in the great big family home?
Yeah, so Dad was born into a household where his mother and father were living with their mother and father, so a multi-generational household, which wasn't unusual at the time. The family next door, the Tossels, they had similar arrangements. And yeah, as a question of economics, you know, people didn't have the money to just, once you get married, you go out and, you know, start your own household. So they were living with his grandma and grandpa, who became known in the family as Min and Galdi. That's what my dad called his grandma and grandpa. And then they also had boarders to
right.
to help with the the family household finances. So the boarder was often it was like the school teacher or the postmaster, somebody who came to town to work. They would be given the best room in the house, the most spacious. They would get served lunch at the dining room table while the rest of the family are sort of all cramped in.
I mean, the cold cuts.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. This reminds me of the Icelandic sagas. You've got this kind of big, huge space, which is the land all around you, which is very almost depopulated, and then everyone living together in this tiny, crammed together. Do you wonder why they didn't kill each other? I mean, being crammed together in such a tiny space together?
Yeah, well, what strikes me, I suppose, as being a parent, the idea that you have this, dad was born as a newborn baby in this bedroom and they're all sort of trying to keep him quiet. If you wake up in the night, dad's grandma would come in and she'd be playing a light, a torchlight over the pictures on the wall and telling stories. And, they're all desperate to keep the baby quiet so that the boarder didn't get interrupted sleep. So, it was...
Got everything for the boarder then, huh? Yeah. Right.
Because they're bringing in money.
Oh, gee, and that would have gotten old pretty quick, I reckon.
Yeah, that's right.
But they needed the money. So, because it's the Great Depression, this period.
Great Depression, My grandpa was a butcher, and so he got, as part of his wage, he got meat rations. So that helped with the family budget as well, that they were, having meat that he would bring home from the butcher shop. They'd grow their own vegetables, chooks, that sort of thing. And that's what everybody was doing.
This is your grandfather, Gus. What was his workday like?
Well, being a butcher back then involved a lot more than just serving meat. So he would be getting up before dawn, go down to the stables, hitch up the horse and cart, go around to the butcher shop, cut all the cuts of meat. You're making your own sausages and own small goods and all those sorts of things. And then they'd do that on a certain, afternoon. But you'd load up your butcher cart then, and then go around the town serving meat. People would come out with their platter or a tin pot or something or other and say, well, I would like, string of sausages or lamb's fry or, serving of chops. Serve it at the back of the cart and they'd take it inside and he'd go on, clip-clop on to the next customer. The horse, of course, would know its way around the town. And then go back in the afternoon and then they'd take turns serving in the shop. But, there was... And then, unhitch the horse, go and take care of the horse. So it was a huge work day.
So he'd have to be a horse and cart man, he'd have to be a shop man, a small goods maker, and a slaughterman as well.
That's right.
So here's the question though about Gus. Did he like being a butcher?
Well, I remember, one of the most sad memories for me is that I remember Grandpa saying to me when I was, a teenager or whatever, admitting that he had nightmares about killing animals, killing the beasts, because he'd done that all his life, and in his 70s and 80s that was still on his mind and causing him grief that he had, had to slaughter these animals, but it was part of being a butcher. And back then in the 1920s, 1930s and earlier, you didn't question what sort of profession you might like. If a job was available and you needed it, you took it. And he spent his whole life and even then, after he finished as a butcher, because people knew that he had those skills, if they were on a farm, farmers, and people would say, oh, Gus, can you come out and just, slaughter a couple of sheep for us or whatever. And so he was still doing it even when it wasn't his job anymore. He couldn't get away from it.
Oh, even though it gave him nightmares. Mm. God, that's a hellish life in some ways, isn't it? I suppose he just learned to push it all down.
Yeah, I guess he just coped with it. During the war, he did come to Adelaide and sort of tried to do something else, but then it was all the, I've forgotten the name of the government agency that basically told people what they, what they needed to do during the war.
Oh, yeah, yes.
Manpower, I think it was. And so they basically said, well, you're a butcher. You have to be a butcher. You can't go off and, try and be a haberdasher salesman or something.
There were shops in town that are congregation places for men and for women. Was the barber shop a big hangout for men to come in and get a shave and a haircut?
That's right. Yeah, I think the women, they went to the hairdressers. And so the barber shop was a communal place. You got your tobacco supplies there. And again, during the war when things were short, if you were not a regular barber shop customer, you were not going to be getting tobacco when that was on rations. Dad would remember sitting in the barber's chair as a youngster, and you're told you don't tell lies, you always tell the truth. And he'd see people come in, men would come in and say, oh, I've got any tobacco? Oh, no, sorry, nothing today. And someone else, no, nothing today. And then the next customer come in, oh, yes, and he'd just bend down under the counter and out would come a pouch of tobacco for the regular customer who gets his cutthroat shave or haircut there.
The barber didn't really seem to care if he got work or not.
Well, there were several barbers in Moonta. I mean, again, there was, at one point there was 9 butchers and a whole lot of different tradespeople, but there was three barbershops that Dad remembers, and but Sam Tripp was a one that stuck in everybody's minds, and so he didn't seem too concerned about the amount of customers that came through the door. And occasionally my grandpa would go in and think, oh, well, I'll, you know, favour Sam Tripp with some business and go in and get my, get a shave, you know, even if he didn't really mean it. And so he'd walk in the door there and Sam would be sitting in the barber's chair himself reading the paper and sort of see grandpa walk in and say, oh, would you believe it? I've just sat down to have 5 minutes rest and you've come in, oh, right, you know. So it's kind of hard to favour him with business.
Oh, God, I have to work.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
We talked a bit about the men from this time in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. And tell me about the women, though. Cooking Day. There was one day for cooking, especially. And what was that and how did it work?
Well, it was Saturday they baked and did a lot of baking. So, you know, all the sort of morning tea and dessert treats for the week, a lot of, you know, well, saffron buns is the Cornish.
What is a saffron bun?
So saffron bun, we still make saffron buns. They are basically a fruit yeast bun with saffron in it. So, and there's a lot of ritual around. It takes a lot of time, about 2 hours to sort of mix it all up. Then they sit for we'd normally make it in the evening and let them sit overnight and rise, and then in the morning baking them. So it makes, our recipe makes about six dozen buns. I think originally my grandma used to make cakes, but and then the leftover recipe would be made into buns, but we all decided that the buns would be were nicer, so we
made the cake, buns. Right, yeah. So and there would be like roasting that would go on as well?
Yeah, so, and this is all in a little wood stove, you know, so it didn't matter if it was the middle of summer, you'd be stoking up this wood stove to get everything cooked for the day or for the week, basically. Sunday there'd be roast meat, so then you could have cold meat on Monday, which was washing day.
Do you see this as, I mean, I think this is a real blind spot of the British migrants to Australia, transplanting these habits into a place like Moonta, where you, in summer you would get like maybe a fortnight of 45 degree heat. Mm-hmm. And nonetheless, on a Saturday, a woman would be tending a blazing hot stove in a blazing hot house.
That's right. My dad remembers, Christmas Day, you know, the same thing, you know, the heat of Christmas Day. And there's his grandma in there again with this little wooden stove baking, you know, roast turkey and Christmas, hot Christmas pudding and custard and all of those sort of trimmings in the fierce heat.
Amazing. Unfathomable, isn't it? I asked my mum about this and she said that there was a famous saying about Cornish, Cousin Jacks and the Cousin Jennies of that area, about what they liked for dinner. She said there'd be meat at one side of the plate, veggies at the other and a cup of tea in the middle. How true is that?
Well, my dad drank black tea, nothing in it, all his life. And again, middle of summer, doesn't matter. Wouldn't be a cool drink or a beer, it would be a cup of tea.
What did washing day involve?
Well, washing day was the whole day, and there was quite a bit of prestige to be the first woman to get your white sheets out on the line on washing day. Like, who had made the earliest start to have their washing on the line first? Of course, it was, you know, firing up the fire in the copper to get the water hot. My dad's grandpa, Goldie, did one time a big booby by thinking he would favour, you know, the women by getting the copper going, and made a big fire in the copper and didn't realise that there'd been sheets put in there in preparation for washing, but no water in there. So he ended up just burning all the
scorching
sheets.
Scorching them, right. Yeah.
But, yeah, so doing the washing and the mangling and then drying them and then, of course, bringing everything in and ironing them again with an iron that needed to be heated up on a fire, that sort of thing.
Is this a perilous process? Because aren't these towns got a lot of, like, you know, red dirt and red dust and everything else? I mean, how on earth do you get pristine white sheets in that environment? I have no idea.
Yeah, it's the skimp dumps from the mines were, yeah, this red sort of brass or bronzy sort of colour. I remember as a child we used to ride our motorbikes up and down over the skimp dumps. There's these huge sort of mountains on the outskirts of town, which of course are all heritage listed now. And in earlier days, to produce the power for the mine, they cut down all the trees all around Moonta to feed the voracious supply, you know, appetite of wood for the mines. And of course, then the
made
dust
everything
just
hotter
blew
and drier
all over
and
the town and everything.
Yeah.
So then they had to replant all the trees again. But yeah, keeping things clean was a challenge.
Tell me how your dad, as a boy, once destroyed washing day.
So, and I remember this too. My grandma had washing lines, like most of the women did, which were sort of these just metal poles hoisted up in the yard with a big, with a thin metal wire strung between them. That was the washing line. So it just sort of went the whole length of the yard. So he came home from school. He was in high school and they'd been studying Shakespeare at school. And so he was sort of walking. He walked around the corner of the yard. And just at that moment, my grandma had been hanging up the washing and put this, you know, all the sheets over the line. And wind came, you know, whipped it all up and turned it all over. And the pole fell down and all the washing fell down in the ground. So, of course, she was aghast and turned around and in fury and looked. And Dad sort of saw her looking at him and thinking she's looking for someone to blame. And he said, "Never shake thy gory locks at me." And Shakespeare came out at the appropriate time.
But, you know, I suppose with your grandmother, that was a whole day's hard labour that had come to nothing with the dirty sheets on the ground.
That's right. She needed somebody to blame.
Yeah. I'm feeling responsible somehow myself. I don't know. Was it the nature of the Cornish folk of Moonta that they could be rather obstinate in their quarrels?
Yes, stubborn. They were very superstitious and stubborn. So there was a family rift in our family where my dad's grandpa and his sister fell out and didn't speak for years and years and years over the belongings of their, you know, mother when she died. And yeah, rocking chair was the main item that they were, you know, at odds over.
They fell out over a rocking chair.
Which from my dad's memory was pretty decrepit and, you know, just sat in the shed. My dad's grandpa was the winner of the rocking chair, but it was never used as far as Dad could see, and it led to this rift between the two of them, Galdi and his sister Hilda, that was, you know, went for the end of their lives. They didn't reconcile before either of them died.
Religion, the question of religion in the town, it had a strong Methodist flavour, like you said, and that was from the Cornish mining folk. So it was mainly a Methodist town. Did the Anglicans and Catholics have a presence in that town as well?
Very minor. So there is still one Anglican church and one Catholic church, but as I said, there would have been, you know, 10 or 12 Methodist chapels, and there's, you know, still Methodist churches there now. So they had a minor presence. Methodism was the major, which is now the Uniting Church. But, of course, the Salvation Army came in too. They
What happened when they came in, when the Salvos came in?
Well, there was a lot of, they, you know, sort of turned the town upside down. They would march through the streets with their brass band and get the ire up of the local residents. And the Methodists were sort of much more sort of holier than thou and sort of really looked down on the goings on at the Salvation Army lodges. They were much more boisterous and, you know, they would take people in who'd, you know, fallen.
Yes, they'd pick up a sinner from the roadside, wouldn't they? Yes. Oh, and they'd pick, right, so they'd welcome, you know, alcoholics who wanted reform or people who'd sinned and fallen on the wayside. Were the Salvos more willing to take them in?
They would, yes, save them. And so my my dad's grandma, Min, who he lived with, she, you know, she was a staunch Methodist, but the Tossels who lived next door, they were Salvation Army, Salvationists. So even though Min sort of thought, you know, she was much more well-to-do being a Methodist than the Salvos next door, she nevertheless loved to hear about the goings-on at the Salvation Army Lodge. So she would climb up. They had a stone on either side, Mrs. Tossel and Min, because they were both being Cornish stock quite short, and they would climb up on their stone so they could trade gossip and everything, and Min would always want to know what was the latest goings on at the Salvation Army Lodge, and Mrs. Tosser would be telling her about, you know, they'd get into actual physical fights, and she said at one time, and they tore Aunt Sosa's hat because they got so in such a riot at the Salvation Army Lodge.
So it's kind of like they brought rock and roll or something to Moonta by the sound of things. Gregarious musical meetings, taking in sinners, all that sort of thing.
And, that's right.
And a bit noisy with it. How did all that brass band playing go over amongst the quiet Methodist folk of
Well,
Moonta?
There were letters to the editor. I remember one particular one in, I think it was in Cadena, where somebody wrote in and was complaining that there was, you know, someone was ill and, you know, how on earth is somebody supposed to recuperate with all this, you know, goings on of these brass band marching up and down the street, and could they not have some compassion? And
yeah, I think after a while the brass band down the street might get a bit wearisome. Nonetheless, it's kind of way that it's fascinating to see how those two cultures interacted with one another. As I said right at the start, there was the odd sort of ghastly murder, and there was an infamous incident that took place in a farmhouse just outside of Moonta in 1931. Can you tell the story of what happened on that day?
That was a really tragic story. Well, 1931, it was just a couple of years before my dad was born, but he knew, the story goes, the farmhand was working for the Cadd family.
And how old was he?
He was only 17, and he had been working for them for a number of years and was they'd had no problem with him. And he was, one afternoon, they all came in and had lunch together. And during lunchtime, as he sort of told the police afterwards, he just decided he would kill Mrs. Cadd.
So was Mr. Cadd in the house at the time?
They had lunch together, and then Mr. Cadd went out to continue his farm work. And this Arthur James, his name was, knew where the gun was, he knew where the bullets were. And he says he just decided that he was going to kill Mrs. Cadd that day. So,
and how did he do so?
So she, went into the dining room or whatever to clear the plates and came back in, and he just shot her with the rifle and shot her again. And then the little boy, Ron Cadd, who was only six, I think, came into the room, and he, pistol whipped him with the butt of the rifle. And I think then because he said he got along quite well with the little boy, so it was just inexplicable that he would attack him. And I think that then maybe sort of, he realised what he'd done.
Took him out of this strange
this reverie
state
or whatever he'd been in. Yeah, and he actually called then for help, he called up the neighbour, who was Mrs. Cadd's sister, I think, and said, you better come here and see what I've done. Called her over, and of course she came across this horrible scene of the woman, having been shot and
Still alive. Right.
Yeah, and then the boy needing help. And so then they went and got Mr. Cadd, and then they had obviously got the town doctor. These are all people coming on horse and cart, so it's not immediate assistance. And, then when they asked the young farmhand, Arthur James, why? And he sort of said, I just felt I had to do it, and didn't really give any explanation. He hadn't been ill-treated. But then later on, once he was, there was a whole court case and everything, but there was a lot of rumours about what might have been going on out there at the farm, and that this young lad had, as one of the neighbours said, had been hopping into a pig.
Hopping into a pig.
Mm.
And was the supposition that Mrs. Cadd had accidentally witnessed this?
That Mrs. Cadd had seen this farmhand acting inappropriately with the farm stock was the rumour that circulated throughout the town, and still does, and that's why this farmhand had felt that he needed to kill Mrs. Cadd to stop her telling what she'd seen.
So that could be true. It could be true. It also could be true. He had a strange kind of, what would you call it? A kind of odd
dissociation.
I think what they call it, a dissociative episode.
He freely admitted, that what he'd done, and he was charged with murder and sentenced to death.
Because Mrs. Cadd died?
Mrs. Cadd, yes, she was taken to hospital and died later that night,
And what about the little boy?
And the little boy survived, so he grew up and stayed in Moonta and lived with that, for his life, the rest of his life.
This reminds me of Crime and Punishment, and one of the reasons why the murder takes place in that novel is because he's just... What should stop him from doing such a thing? Mm. That thought.
It was almost as if he sort of saw the weapon there and an opportunity, and just thought, well, why not?
What would happen?
Arthur James, even though he was sentenced to death, the court then took leniency on him because he was only 17, and he was not executed, and he didn't return to Moonta, but he sort of lived in that sort of broader region.
Was he and his crime remembered in the family?
I actually interviewed Ron Cadd's wife for my book. Went and spoke to her, obviously, as an older woman. She's now since passed. Ron Cadd had died.
This is the little boy.
The little boy grew up, yes. Yeah. And by the time I started doing my research, he had passed away, but his wife was still alive. And so I talked to her about, what had happened, and...
What a ghastly episode for him to have witnessed as a boy, and then to be assaulted like that.
Yeah, and to lose his mother.
And what about the killer himself, Arthur James, his family?
I did talk to, what turns out to be Arthur James's nephew, is someone I spoke to, and it was a neighbour of ours. And he didn't know about it until his sort of later teenage years. It was just never was spoken about in the family. They, you know, were obviously ashamed. But, you know, the people of Moonta also, you know, he was at school, this nephew, so he... There would have been ample opportunity. Everybody knew about this murder in town, so there would have been a lot of times when, you know, teenage boys, whatever, people could have come to him and said, you know, how about what your uncle did or whatever, but it would just was never spoken about to him. So he sort of thought that that was a good reflection on the people of Moonta, that they wouldn't take it out on this nephew.
That was a kindness.
Yeah. Yeah, that they were sort of good enough people, good-hearted enough people to sort of not judge him on this stain on his larger family.
Your dad would have been, 6 years old when war was declared in 1939, when Prime Minister Menzies went on the radio and said, Britain is at war, and as a result, Australia is also at war. Does your dad remember that?
Yeah, he said it was a warm night, and Grandpa, Gus, went around to the shop to get ice creams, and he came back from the shop and said, war's been declared. And, you know, of course, my dad at 6 years old didn't really realise that what that meant. But
it was of secondary importance to the ice cream.
Ice creams, sure. Everybody's looking miserable, and the ice creams are all just melting on the floor because nobody's feeling like ice cream anymore. So that was his memory of war being declared.
And how did the town of Moonta change during the war?
There were, you know, obviously drives to raise scrap metal, and they had these sort of... penny drives with pennies lined up the length of George Street. You know, how
what
many
for?
Can we... Just to raise money, to raise funds for the war effort. My dad and his friends organised a little sort of boys... I called it a boys' own fair. It got reported in the newspaper in Adelaide that these young lads had organised a fair where they were selling off their... Or you could come and view their metal toys and have rides in a soapbox go-kart and those kind of things to raise money for it was the Fighting Forces Comforts Fund. And the women of the town were knitting, you know, socks and mittens and, you know, baking biscuits and sort of putting together these comfort packages. And so my dad and his mates thought they could raise some money to help out with the effort.
You said there were like all these civil defence measures put in place. Was there really any concern that the Japanese or the Germans were going to invade?
I don't think
so. That end of Australia? It's the wrong end of Australia, I would have thought.
Yeah, that's right.
But nonetheless, that was taken quite seriously.
Yeah, I mean, looking back on it now, it's a lot, you know, sort of Dad's Army kind of episode. But they dug trenches at the primary school, so all the men of the town got out there with their picks and shovels and built these trenches so that the school children could run in there and crouch down and hide if the Japanese planes were to come over.
I'm getting an image in my head of Admiral Yamamoto poring over a map with Moonta with a big cross over it and a line going towards it. Yeah,
yeah, it seems so. Unbelievable, but it was all taken very seriously, and the trenches were built or dug on an angle so that, you know, they were thinking, well, then they can't just come along and strafe in one line. They wouldn't be able to do that. So it was taken very seriously.
After the war, you were talking before about how your dad worked in the wheat yards as a young man, and the kind of work that was quite hard physical work, but it didn't seem like he minded it very much. Tell me, what kind of initiation pranks were played on your father in those days?
Well, my dad loved telling the story of this fool's errand, as he called it. So he didn't actually, I think, wasn't the butt of this particular one, but it was, I guess, stuck in his mind because it got completely out of hand. So the trick was with the new wheat boy would be told to go and find a wheat saw. Of course, there is no such thing. There is
a wheat
no
saw.
Wheat saw.
Right.
But they would sort of say to the new, you know, green behind the ears lad coming in, go down and ask at the, you know, the shed for the wheat saw. So the wheat boy would go down there, and if you got the wheat saw, no, you have to go to the other side of the compound and ask them. Anyway, somebody else who didn't know about this, you know, that it was all a prank, said to the wheat boy, but I think somebody from the council, you know, they often come and get our stuff. Go down there and ask them. So he goes down to the council yard, you know, if you've got the wheat. So, Garnet Bridgman at the powerhouse might have it. So now it's going up the chain and getting a lot more serious because they're going to more, you know, this poor lad is getting sent to more senior people. Garnet Bridgman was in charge of the town powerhouse, so it was his job to keep the electricity running, you know, these big diesel engines to supply power to the town. So, of course, he doesn't know about any prank at the wheat yards. So he's scratching his head and, oh, no, he gives the boy all of these different saws and implements that it might be, and he puts them in his basket and cycles back to the wheat yard. But after he's left, Garnet Bridgman's thinking, oh, well, maybe it was this one. So he gets in his little car by that stage and drives over to the, you know, the wheat yard, and then has to be told, well, it was all just a bit of a prank. So yeah, very awkward.
Think a little bit harder about that idea, yeah. A saw that can cut through wheat, yes. Your dad eventually left. He took on a multitude of jobs and then went very far with his education. How proud was the family to have a man of letters?
That's right. So Dad went to university and got a science degree, Bachelor of Science. And, a lot of pride. He was, of course, the first person to go to university. When he finished school, leaving and then, what's the next?
Intermediate, I think.
So a lot of people finish school after... year 10.
They left it leaving.
Yeah, yes. Left it leaving, yeah. Why would you stay? Dad was interested in, he's smart, and he was, in later life when I knew him, very knowledgeable, interested in, arts and culture and all kinds of things. So he was keen to carry on. He ended up studying his final years at high school in Kadena because there was a wider range of subjects on offer there, came down to town and went to university. And so it was a big honour and a lot of pride for his mum and dad and grandma Min to go down and see Dad graduate from university and finish his education.
While he went out into the wider world, eventually, of course, your grandfather died and then your grandmother. Tell me what happened to the family photos after your grandmother's death.
This was actually, it would have been my dad's grandma. It was Min who died. This goes back to this fight between my dad's grandpa, Galdi, and his sister, Hilda, who fought over the rocking chair, never made up. So Galdi eventually died, and then Min, his wife, died, which was my dad's grandma. And this Hilda, this Auntie Hilda, marched in and basically just started, chucking stuff out that, I guess had belonged, some of those things had belonged to her brother, but they were nothing to do with her. So she sort of just railroaded over my dad's mother, who was grieving for her mum. But this auntie sort of took that opportunity to come in and just chuck stuff out, and all the photos, all the family photos, anything that had her brother in it, Galdi, just, threw them in the fire. And my dad... Yeah, just destroyed them.
Why?
Horrible.
What, just as part of the feud or what?
Or revenge. I don't know. But my dad told me that he found one later on, a photograph, one single photo that had been torn into little pieces about the size of a postage stamp, that was a picture of his grandpa Galdi walking along with another man down in Adelaide, and he stuck them all back together to have this one remaining photograph of his grandpa, but that has now since been gone. So, when I was doing the research for the book, I looked through a lot of the National Trust up at Moonta has lots of old photographs that they've catalogued and, I thought it would be nice if one appeared somewhere, but I haven't been able to find one. So, yeah, it was really sad that they were destroyed.
Part of the way through the writing of this book, your dad passed away. How did he die?
He had a heart attack. He died in his sleep. So, we were making saffron buns on the Saturday evening. So it was, lovely that we were doing something that was such a treasured thing for him. Of course, we had no idea what was about to unfold, but we made the saffron buns, and I'd been down there helping him with my daughter, so we'd all been together. And in the morning, my mum called, and he couldn't wake him up, so he just went in his sleep, which was horrible for us. But can't ask for, I suppose, a better death, I guess, if you want to put it that way. Passed away peacefully. He was such an active man who spent many hours out in the shed and working on things, interested in cars and trucks and motorbikes and all those sort of things. So for him to sort of wither away would have been, a painful end. So, we have to sort of give thanks for that, I guess.
You know, people today, like people like us and other people, have such different lives to the lives of the people you describe here. Such different, completely different lives. You know, international travel, air-conditioned houses, you know, consumer goods, all those sorts of things. And the country's a much richer country now than it was in that time. What do you think of that when you look back at the lives of your ancestors in this South Australian mining town compared to the life you have now?
Well, there was it's still an oft-quoted phrase that says, if you haven't been to Moonta, you haven't travelled. And that,
if you haven't been to Moonta, you haven't travelled.
That's right. So Moonta was regarded, you know, as the centre of the universe for the people there. And, you know, it was, this, again, Captain Hancock ruled over this domain. Moonta Copper was famous. The Moonta miners were famous. So I think for a lot of people at Moonta, well, why would you go anywhere else? You know, you're no one if you haven't been here. And if we're here, we don't need to go anywhere else. So Dad's heart was always close to home, close to Moonta, and I feel that it's my second home too. I've travelled a lot, but it's still somewhere I come back to.
What a pleasure it has been to speak with you about this, and thank you so much, Kristen.
Thanks, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.